I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Good urban design is central to any city's success, and today's guests are shaping cities in important ways by making and celebrating good design. Simeon Bruner is founder of the Rudy Bruner Award for Urban Excellence, a national award for urban places, and this year's gold medal winner is the Pittsburgh Children's Museum and the Family District. We'll talk to Simeon about the competition and the projects recognized this year. Also with us is Margie Nothard, designer of an outstanding new public space in Hollywood, Florida, Arts Park at Young Circle, which may define a whole new category of urban amenity. Our subject is urban design today on Smart City, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Simeon Bruner is founding principal of Bruner Cott and founder of the Rudy Bruner Award for Urban Excellence, a nationally recognized award for urban architecture. Simeon was principal in charge of Mass Mocha, and his current projects include 45 Province Street, a 31-story condominium in downtown Boston, the Wadsworth Athenaeum expansion in Hartford, Connecticut, and the new Safra Center for the Arts at Brandeis University. Simeon, what was your original impulse for creating the Rudy Bruner Award for Urban Excellence?
Well, years ago when we first started the award, it was clear that awards in architecture would be given by magazines who were more concerned at that point about the kinds of images that would appear on their covers than really the complex trade-offs we all make in a real building in the real world. So it's important to me as a practicing architect to talk about those trade-offs and talk about the interesting things that a building can do beyond the edges of its site for its city, for its neighborhood, and for the community.
What are some of those things?
Well, in the first place, the building itself needs to reflect the community, needs to talk about the ideals of the community. It can become either a magnet for things that are happening in the community. It can reflect what's happening in the community. It can become a park or an art piece that adds to the community. It can become housing that adds to the housing stock. So there are a number of ways that the project can work. And what's interesting about the Rudy Bruner Award is that rather than suggesting the answers, we go out and we look and we see what's been done in the real world that exists out there and then talk about how these projects, like the 2007 winners, can work in the community.
You've just announced this year's gold medal winner, the Children's Museum of Pittsburgh. What was it about the Children's Museum that deserved the award?
Well, I think what everyone loved at the museum was, first of all, it was a piece of the neighborhood in historic Pittsburgh. It was part of a necklace of revitalization that's happening in a pretty dilapidated city. It's both a LEED certified building. It combines historic preservation, innovative new architecture, and a rather unique collaboration between agencies and organizations who are working to revitalize a downtown.
You've been making the award for how many years?
Probably 22 years now. It's a biennial award, and every 2 years we go out and look for new projects.
How have the award winners changed over the years?
That's an interesting question, Carol. The first award winner was Pike Place Market, which everyone knows is a sort of a Robin Hood egalitarian market in Seattle, which has been around for quite a while. I think they become more complex. I think the issues they are attacking are more complex. Often they're not as large as they used to be. I think what we're finding is there are smaller solutions to more complex problems rather than simpler solutions to larger problems.
When you say they are more complex, what do you mean? Give me an example.
Well, for example, this year's gold medalist, the Children's Museum in Pittsburgh, not only is working to fill a niche in a very dilapidated downtown, but it's doing it with both preservation, new architecture, it's collaboration among agencies, it's a LEED certified, that is an energy efficient building. It's actually a very highly energy efficient building. So it's working on a number of levels. It's not simply a children's museum. It's not simply a creative new building. It's all of these things together working to make a special place.
Are there characteristics that award winners through the years have in common?
think so. I think they are examples of, first of all, they're all outstanding projects. And what's interesting is we do a rather thorough study of them. We actually send a team of three or four experts to visit each of the finalists to understand how they work. And these are published in monographs that are available online under the Bruner Foundation or the Rudy Bruner Award website. But what's interesting about them is the, I think, first of all, the thoroughness which we look at them, and I think the fact that most of them have a couple of people, a person or persons who are pushing them. They are have effects beyond the parameters of the site. They tend to take a problem which might hitherto be thought of as difficult or almost insolvable and find ways of solving them. And the current ones have to find more ways which combine different sources of financing, different perspectives than the older ones. They're more complex.
Do you think architects are more concerned with the effects beyond the site?
I think so. I think we're seeing it in our zoning. We're seeing it, for example, the American Institute of Architects is now going to actually visit a building and see what it looks like in the site as opposed to relying on photographs. And I know from my own work that people are much more concerned about the setting of the building than they were ever before. I think that's fantastic.
Why do you think that's true?
Because I think that the social aspects of architecture, the parts that go beyond the form, have become increasingly important. I think the public hopefully is becoming aware that buildings need to not only look good but work well, and that they can you can have a building that both looks good and works well and is affordable and is built on time and works in the site and so forth.
Where does sustainability fit into your criteria?
Well, that's interesting. I need to back up. We, as the who run the award, don't actually make the selection. We have a selection team of about six members. This year it was the Honorable Manny Diaz, who's the mayor of Miami, Florida, Reese Fade, who runs Livable Cities, Bob Crone, who's the chief architect for the Boston Redevelopment Authority, Reed Koloff, who's the dean of Tulane School of Architecture, David Perry, director of Great Cities, and Josephine Ramirez, who runs city planning for the Music Center in Los Angeles. And what you can really see is that this is a fairly diverse group coming from design through community development through a mayor who makes the hard decisions. And what they do is talk about the hard trade-offs that you need to make to find the five finalists, in this case six, or the winner. And what we do is we select a selection committee every year, and then they keep us posted what's important. So what we need to do is find people who know more than we do in the field who selected, and this year's committee was a fantastic committee.
So you give them no criteria?
We have two criteria. Our criteria are it needs to be built, and it needs to be urban. Now, built has meant something as ephemeral as the Green Market in New York, which exists on Wednesdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays and Mondays, but doesn't exist at the parking lot other time, and urban has meant something as urban as a stole bike path. So it's really up to the committee to decide what they think is built in urban. Built because it needs to be real, and urban because we're about urban issues, not about suburban issues. But they decide that.
Do they then decide among themselves what criteria they will use to evaluate the submissions?
It's fascinating to be a fly on the wall to listen to the committee's work, because the committees work differently. Some committees want to talk about evaluation by criteria. Some want to simply read the applicants and understand what criteria might emerge from the applicants. Others allow each individual member to talk about his or her own criteria and then have the discussion either before or during the selection process. It's quite interesting to hear how they go differently. It's also interesting to hear the trade-offs that the committee members make among themselves as they work forward. And I think this year, for example, each member started with favorites that did not wind up being the finalists. And the discussion and the trade-offs that get to the finalists and then get to the winner is what makes it so exciting.
Give me an example of those trade-offs.
Well, one trade-off might be, is this the best example of a children's museum? And then the trade-off might be, well, this is in Pittsburgh, which is almost impossible to do anything important in, but it's also LEED and it's new construction. And then how do you so that's a series of trade-offs. Then how do you compare a children's museum to, for example, a Artists for Humanity Epicenter in Boston. And how can you compare a artist's teaching building to a children's museum to a crossroad project in or a bridge in Milwaukee, Wisconsin? And then how do you know what's, is it more important because it's bigger? Is it more important because it's more imaginative, because it looks better, because it connects more people? And what do you mean when you say this is the winner, and why is the gold medalist above the silver medalist? In this case, it was a combination of the difficulty in Pittsburgh, the LEEDS, the energy certification, the historic preservation, the wonderful new architecture, and the collaboration. And it was all those making it a much more complicated project than the others that gave it the gold over the other civil medalists, which are wonderful projects, by the way. What we hoped to accomplish was increase the public's awareness that architecture can be more if they only ask for it. And that to the extent that we ask for better buildings, buildings which are not just beautiful or not just functional or not just inexpensive or not just full of space, the buildings that are art in themselves but also enhance the urban scene by the function, by their looks, by the way they increase interaction, by the examples they set. I think if we ask for that, we'll get that, and by getting that, our cities will be better.
This year, you had some pretty remarkable silver medal winners. Tell me about them.
Sure. Artists for Humanity's Epicenter is a project in Boston. It's another LEED certified building, a platinum this time, the best you can get, which really deals with helping kids in poor communities not drop out of school. It does it through intensive art education, and it supports itself by selling the art that the kids create, by using the space itself for rentals, and by donations. So it's a fascinating program which, through art, works with kids in school to maintain their grades and to keep them in school. The Crossroads Project is an incredibly designed bridge in Milwaukee. It's a bridge that's hung under an older crossing. And it's really for pedestrian and bicycle bridge crossing two sides of the river. In Seattle, High Point Redevelopment is an example of a HOPE 6 project where it's a green community with a broad range of building types. And the way they dealt with the water runoff, which is, of course, a major problem in Seattle, is just astounding. They've got collection pools. They're on a bunch of series of creeks and watersheds, and they have had zero impact on those watersheds by their careful energy and water management. In L.A., the L.A. Design Center is a new furniture showroom and commercial space in the middle of a depressed area, which is will be a furniture showroom for the city. It's a private project with no public assistance, and it's attracting a lot of visitors to this area. And hopefully, over the years, it will become a major center for interior furnishings in L.A. And Columbus Circle, New York, it's interesting because it transformed the center of a contested intersection with a brand-new urban space. And what's interesting there is the quality of the design and the quality of thinking in the traffic control that went around it as it relates to Central Park and to the city in general.
As you look back on past awards that you've given, do you see any that haven't stood the test of time that maybe you wish you hadn't recognized with a medal?
I do. And what's interesting to look at those projects is the report from the selection committee, which talks about some of their strengths and weaknesses. And to the extent that we understood them, we were thinking forward. To the extent that we miss some of them, it's food for us, our thought, in terms of our future evaluations. Years ago, we did a relook at the winners with HUD, actually, and HUD helped finance it, going back and looking at 10 years worth of awards and trying to understand where we understood the issues and where we didn't. And that also is available on the Bruner Award website.
What is it about those projects that makes them now questionable?
What's interesting, I think, is when you're doing an award process, you rely on the photographs and the descriptions submitted by the entrants, and no one that I know has ever intentionally sent a picture of the back of the building. Sometimes when you walk around the back and you say, does this building work, or is it 5 feet from a parking lot? Could they made it 10 feet? Could they have designed the windows differently? You see things in the interviews and in the looking at the project and understanding how it works that you wouldn't otherwise see in the, you know, 20 or 15 page entry form that you get. So you learn a lot about how the project really works in the 5 days of the site, and that's what makes, I think, our site report so interesting, those detailed information about how it really works. So in a funny way, you almost learn as much about ones that don't work as you want to about ones that do work.
Is there a thread that makes them not work?
I think it depends. There isn't a thread, because if you look even at this year's winners, we go all the way from a children's museum to a bridge to a furniture showroom. So it's hard to put threads of things that don't work through there. I would say the ones that don't win, and I think work and win are not necessarily the same issue. Mm. I think they're wonderful buildings that don't win the award. They don't win the award because they aren't a new example. They're simply perhaps a wonderful building, but they are either highly derivative. They may succeed on three or four of the criteria that year's selection committee wants, but not on another. They may not explain themselves well enough so that they can win. And we've had projects that have re-entered and won after not being premiated in even two or three rounds. So that's always interesting. I think what's interesting to selection committees in general, and frankly why we select those selection committees, is the public face of these buildings that goes beyond the building itself, whether the building is private or public. It's what it does beyond its boundaries that I think is a common thread. And there are many buildings that are totally successful within their site, but don't relate outward in any meaningful way. And we believe, I think, and perhaps we select selection committee that believes, that building needs to extend out beyond its site.
Do you have a favorite medal winner, a place you think all urban leaders should see to understand how urban excellence really works?
Every year the winners are my favorites. And I just think that it's been an incredibly exciting experience to go see all these winners and to look at the projects year after year. And I learn a lot. I think that for me the resource is there. And I think if someone has an urban issue they want to look at, come look at our website and take a look at the winners, and they'll find one that's related to the project you're doing.
If you were Mayor Simeon, what would you be doing to encourage urban excellence?
I'd find ways in my zoning to encourage the building to interact beyond the borders of the site, to take on social meaning, to take on physical attributes, so that each building does not stand alone, but the building comes together as a whole with the rest of the city while maintaining its unique identity and place.
Simeon Bruner is founder of the Rudy Bruner Award for Urban Excellence. You're listening to Smart City. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetizen assistant editor Nate Berg.
With building height restrictions that are nearly 100 years old and some of the most expensive rents in the nation, many in Washington, D.C. are beginning to think that it might be time to let the buildings get a little bit taller. The original restriction, passed in 1910, limits building heights to a maximum of 160 feet. But now space is becoming incredibly rare in the district, which has the second lowest vacancy rate and the second highest office space rents in the nation, right behind Manhattan. The Chicago Tribune reports on studies that have found that if the 160-foot height limit were to apply to the entire district, it would generate an additional $10 billion in tax revenue over the next 20 years. But many are still hesitant to support the lift, a move that they fear would undo the uniquely skyscraper-free D.C. skyline. And while Washington, D.C. is trying to hold on to the past, Chicago is letting a little bit go. The city has recently leased 4 publicly owned parking garages to private business. The lease of the parking garages has generated $122 million for the city, the entirety of which has been earmarked for citywide improvements to public parks. Mayor Richard Daley has released plans for more than 100 park improvement projects, including general maintenance and the creation of 50 new playgrounds. Officials and parks advocates have welcomed the leasing program, crediting it with bringing in the city's largest single source of parks funding in more than 20 years. And though times are good for parks in Chicago, parks in California may be in danger of invasion and partial destruction, and it's all because of renewable energy legislation that is intended to ease the human burden on the environment. Passed in 2006, the law mandates that by the year 2010, 20% of California's energy must come from renewable sources like wind turbines and solar panels. But the law could pose a threat to some of the state's pristine open spaces and natural parks. An article in the California Planning and Development Report looks at how plans to develop renewable energy sources often require distant locations, and how the transmission lines for these energy generators often have to cut through protected natural areas. For example, a renewable energy transmission line is being planned to run more than 150 miles through parkland and natural habitats to provide energy in San Diego. And though political support for renewable energy sources is currently at an all-time high, the unintended consequences of this legislation may have some officials getting off the bandwagon. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Margie Nothard is president of Glavovic Studio, an architectural and urban design studio in Broward County, Florida. She was previously an urban design professor at Florida Atlantic University. Her projects include large-scale urban design in New York and South Florida, along with institutional, public, commercial, and residential design projects. She also partners with local and national urban designers, landscape architects, architects, and artists to creatively address a wide range of architectural and urban design issues. Margie, I had the opportunity to see the Arts Park site at Young Circle before construction. What was it about the site that you considered special?
The site for me was an opportunity waiting to happen, I think. What was really special for me was the city of Hollywood. I saw it as an emerging place, a place where young families were already living, and a place that I saw was just a wonderful city. The site itself was downtown, right in the heart of the city, and kind of was a place that really wasn't happening in the downtown area. It was a kind of quiet, very dormant site, actually. And it was right in the middle of downtown. So for me, Young Circle was really a place waiting to happen. It was quiet with beautiful trees, but no one was visiting the site. So it was an opportunity that I saw to make something of, rather than a site that was already happening.
And why was nothing happening?
Well, it's about 10 acres of quiet landscaping and surrounded by Federal Highway. So cars were shooting by. The site was very flat. And it was occupied mostly by sort of no one, and there was no real activity unless the city was actually programming events. Those were the kinds of things that were happening, and the city was doing a good job of that. But my goal was to activate that space and create a kind of sense that you could get to it very easily. And so I was actually asked to design a gazebo, and came back with this invention, essentially, of a park that was an arts park, and using the arts and using creativity and a sort of destination, creating a place that you could go to for your family, with your family for the day, for an hour or sort of at lunchtime, and sort of creating a space that anyone could sort of go to. That was my mission with the family and with the arts, get there easily. So we used many, many different tools to achieve that.
Well, you've said several things I want to follow up on. First, let me just clarify. Your project brief was to design a gazebo?
Yes, it's a long story.
Well, tell me about it.
Yeah. Many years ago, and I was originally approached by the then CRA director and through the director of the Art and Culture Center to look at designing a gazebo in the park. The park was run down, and they needed to do some beautification. But when looking at the park, I realized it wasn't about making it look pretty. What you really needed to do was look at where the park was and think of it as a redevelopment tool, because the city was growing, and there was an opportunity to look at the park as a catalyst for redevelopment. And the city was already embracing the arts, and there was a fantastic community already there that was wanting to embrace the arts. And so I came back with a sketch, essentially, that looked at the landscape and looked at art and said, here was a place that could revitalize the downtown. I also happened to be teaching at FAU and believed in kind of the idea of connectedness. And so I realized that if you activated the periphery of the park and celebrated the landscape and the qualities of living in South Florida and attracted people to the edge rather than seen only as a kind of individual element, you could get them across federal highways. So my goal was to create an energy around the perimeter, because I knew that if you kind of just made a single element, that wouldn't be sufficient to attract a destination. So I used the qualities of landscape and sort of water and living in Florida and sort of made a kind of trompe-l'oeil effect, you know, get them across the federal highway. And once they're in the park, create a series of activities that would keep them in the park. So we had to use program at the same time that happened to be that the county was doing an arts park programming. And so there were a series of amazing people that were already interested in doing other things. And people like Mary Becht and Suzanne Gunsberger, Commissioner Gunsberger, were looking at other programs. So the idea for an arts park was ongoing. And Cynthia Berman-Miller at the Art and Culture Center and Mara Galanti, the mayor, and a series of incredible people loved the idea that I was coming up with and embraced this idea. And so went ahead and, to cut a long story short, everyone embraced the mission of a kind of bold and visionary idea to develop an arts park. And so we went from looking at this as a kind of simple beautification project to the city ended up winning the bid to do an arts park project, and that included, and we can go into the sort of whole vision of what we've ended up developing, which was this, you know, $20 million, $25 million project with all its incredible elements.
Well, and I want to talk about those elements. I want to go back and clarify a couple of things. You talked about the public officials. They are primarily associated with Broward County and the city of Hollywood, Florida.
Yes.
Okay. And I'm interested in this notion of an arts park. Did this come from you, or did this come from the public officials?
No, this definitely came from the public officials. It was.
What did they mean by an arts park? They said they wanted an arts park. Okay, what's that? Is there another arts park somewhere, or did this just sort of come to them as a vision of an expression of their commitment to the arts and what they were doing there? And I'm curious how those two ideas got put together. Arts park.
Well, I don't know all the details, but there was a very complex process where it came out of the Broward County Cultural Affairs Division. Mary Becht was the champion of this. There's actually a series of arts parks in Broward County.
Oh, so this is not the only one.
No, it's not. And actually, I do think it's the best one.
But, of course you do.
You know, the county... the public art, there's a public art program in Broward County that's amazing. But Mary Becht and Commissioner Gunsberger, there's a series of arts parks. And the idea for the arts park is to embrace a program whereby the arts is experienced through the landscape. Essentially, and the programming includes pavilions and amphitheaters where you can engage in a public art experience. And this is fulfilled in different forms in different parks in Broward County. In our particular park, we have we experience it in the form of many different forms, and we can go into that. But in Broward County, there are many different arts parks. This came out of a cultural plan that essentially was the idea of the cultural division in Broward County.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so successful that they ended up doing several arts parks. The initial intent, however, was to have one arts park, which the city of Hollywood won. And it was a matching grant, and the city of Hollywood went after it with this arts park. And if the city of Hollywood had to match a $5 million grant, and we won it based on our scheme. And so we had to go after it with the scheme that we had, and it was quite a tough competition. But because it was so popular, they ended up doing several more of them.
Ah.
Yeah.
So they had the brief, you responded, and
exactly. And
they liked so much what you had done, they decided to do more. Tell me about the project now that you've designed, the Arts Park at Young Circle.
Okay, so we ended up doing a project that, in the process, it ended up being phased because of the costs associated during this period. We also, you may know, and throughout the country this occurred, the cost of construction increased dramatically in the last few years, and so we were burdened by that. But the city manager was amazing. His name is Cameron Benson. He figured out a way not to lose the quality and the goals and the mission of the project, which was awesome. So we ended up phasing the project but still getting everything that they wanted in it. So it's three phases. The first phase was the park, which is a 10-acre park, and it includes an integrated art piece. In Broward County, there's a public art program, and the artist who was selected to work on the project with us, her name is Litsko Tahoe. So the idea was, or the concept that I had for the project was to have an experience that really celebrates living in Florida and living in an environment that, at the end of the day, the experience is art, you know, but interactive. So you can experience this in an urban environment. We know there's no apologies for it being suburban, but yet it's a sort of organic experience. So you can have this in the heart of a city, which we don't get to do very often. You know, very often if you feel like you're in an urban environment, it's purely hardscape. And yet this is organic and it's urban, which was a real mission of mine. We didn't remove any trees. We relocated some, but it was a real mission. And I've also elevated the center of parks. It's sort of meandering pathways, and movement is dynamic and flow. So all elements are kind of sculptural. So it evokes, art all the time, and is interactive. There's a series of sculptural forms and points of view, and also constantly allows you to look back at the city so that you're engaging in the periphery and you're sort of looking back at the city and seeing the city as a part of the experience and the landscape as part of the experience. And also maybe looking at the landscape as art, you know, trying to re-examine your point of view. And then there's the main fountain, which is part of the Millennium Springs artwork. I worked very closely with the artist. And the artwork, actually, the fountain responds to a baobab tree, which is part of her artwork. And it's sort of, I don't know if you had a chance to learn a little bit about that, but she measured the life waves of this one baobab tree, and the jets from the fountain are orchestrated by the life waves of the baobab. So they sort of move up and down in sequence with the recorded life waves of the baobab tree, which is pretty unique and amazing kind of interaction. And if you've learned anything about that. Then the park itself is zoned into different areas so that at any time many different experiences occur in the park, so that a person coming in can be in one part of the park. It's sort of, my influences obviously go back to Olmsted and the kind of Central Park spaces, so that you can, in Florida we don't get to have you know, any change in elevation. So an 8-foot change in elevation is a pretty significant thing. You know, we've got our little mountain now in Florida. And that actually is a hugely dramatic experience, even though sometimes people don't realize they're suddenly in these rooms. And I kind of zoned the spaces in the park. And I would say that's probably the single biggest effect that I made in space. And suddenly you're in the middle of the space of the park and you don't realize you feel closer to the to downtown. And people, when they're in the downtown, feel closer to the center. It's a kind of experience that, when you asked me in the beginning of the interview, you know, what sort of change did you make? I would say that the whole space of downtown feels more intimate now.
Mm.
You don't feel like you are removed, and suddenly Yonge Circle feels like a part of the space of downtown now, whereas before you might kind of go in and out of it and you wouldn't want to spend any time there. Now you see moms and in their strollers, you know, crossing the street, crossing Federal Highway to go and walk around the park, which you just would never see before.
Mm-hmm. How difficult is it to get across Federal Highway? You talked about activating the perimeter of the park so that people would, in fact, make that journey. Tell me, again, is it easy to cross the Federal Highway? And what did you do around the perimeter? How did you think about that as a designer, what you needed to do to actually draw people to it?
Yes, that is very significant and was one of the major challenges very early on. The scale of there's four, Joseph Yonge, the founder of Hollywood and also whom the park is named after, his bust is at the west entrance of the park. And it's very important that when you look in plan of the design of this park, I scaled the entrance on the west side to have the same scale, actually, of Hollywood Boulevard on the west side. So physically, there's a kind of proportion where it's almost like there's a contiguous relationship between Hollywood Boulevard and the entrance of the park. So there's a spatial connection. People feel there's a very natural flow there. Plus, we also, the city was very smart in renovating the actual Federal Highway itself and putting very wide walkways and also putting in signals that are very slow and easy to cross and striping. So these three elements, as well as striping across the paving and the sloping up and the changing in elevation, combined with very strong, colorful visual landscaping, these elements all combine to and slowing down the traffic with these visual elements all combine to actually make people feel comfortable when they arrive at this intersection and they pull together and we have colorful landscaping and we also have a pedestrian pathway that goes all the way around. It's 20 feet wide and has bright yellow and stripes, and there's a number of visual elements in this area that literally slow people down to look at. And these all combine to kind of slow you down at these entrances and pull you across the pathway. So it's actually made it very easy to cross. And I think it's been quite successful. People are now crossing the path with their bicycles. They're walking across, and it has really been quite successful. You can see a lot of people in the park now. Doesn't seem to be a problem.
Are there projects from which you took inspiration for this one?
My real inspiration was Olmsted. I mean, I really have to defer to him in terms of it was more landscape architecture that inspired me, and the desire to make public spaces. It was less about architecture and more about landscaping, and that actually in this case, my goal was more, those, I guess that would be the best reference. I also do need to mention that the architects of record on the project were Scharf & Associates. Glavovic Studio, my firm, is the design architecture.
Mm-hmm. Now, the park is not finished. You said
The park is finished, yes, but the visual arts building, the pavilion, will be finished in about a month.
Oh, okay.
Yes, the park is open and was opened in March.
Right, the park is open, but you said there are three phases now.
Yes.
The park was phase one?
Correct.
And then the visual arts pavilion is phase two?
Yes.
And tell me what happens in the Visual Arts Pavilion.
That's going to be absolutely amazing. The Visual Arts Building is actually the first building that will be completed, and that building is going to house the glass-blowing studio, and this is all open to the public, which is this other amazing part of the story. The Arts Park is a public building, so it's for everyone in Broward County. The Visual Arts Building will have a glass-blowing studio, a metal workshop, a high bay painting and sculpture studio, another classroom which will be used for any number of programming items, plus another studio upstairs which will be for, it'll have a sprung floor for dancing and Tai Chi classes and any number of programming things. Plus, it has an outdoor amphitheater space for watching all of the glass blowing and spaces activities. So, plus there'll be an administration space and bathroom facilities. So it's a pavilion that is geared towards supporting the kind of outdoor activities that are going on in the park. And in the park, there's also a series of there's a children's playground that on any given afternoon after school, you will see literally hundreds of kids on these incredible play elements that we brought from Germany that don't really look like traditional play elements.
Ah.
They're discs, and we have a bean stalk that looks like a bamboo element. We have curly bean elements. We have giant discs the kids spin on. We have a play structure that looks kind of like a woven web. We have a big giant play element that kids run up and down that has some interactive fossils and things. We have an interactive children's fountain, and it's so popular. I mean, it's just filled with people all day in the summer. It's just incredible. And we also have a beautiful, beautiful amphitheater ball, which leads me to the third phase, which is going to be the amphitheater performing arts building, which is in a fundraising phase, which is phase three. And they're halfway through the fundraising for that. So the amphitheater bowl itself has been already built and is completely designed for all the sight lines. And we have a temporary stage, and they already have performances twice a month and lots of programming for that in a huge open area in a plaza, which also has performances. The actual park has been designed that you can have performances in about 8 to 10 different parts of the park simultaneously, small, chamber orchestra, little troupes, little puppet shows, all going on. And the city's actually done simultaneous performances throughout the park and different events already. So the goal is to have different types of events to suit different audiences. And they've actually done that already. So it's been quite amazing.
Every city, it seems, is attempting to invent new amenities to increase the city's profile, the quality of life. Do you think the Arts Park may be a new category of amenity?
You know, I think that we're suffering in our schools from a lack of the arts. And children, one of my inspirations has always been the way that children play. You know, it didn't take much, really, to create, for me to just respond in a way to the concept of what an arts park is, because children really do this every day. We don't really need to make spaces that they do this. They do this on their own. So I was inspired by that. And I think your question is really a great one, because we really need more spaces where families can hang out and do this. And I think if cities could give this kind of space to families, it might really make a city, you know, provide exactly what's missing in so much of our, or it's getting less and less of in our educational environment. So I think it would be a really good thing to have.
You submitted, I noticed, on the High Line in New York, you did a skate plaza for Miami Beach. Do you think leisure,
yes,
in cities and the places to support it are being redefined?
Yes, and I think they need to be, because, for example, that project which we're about to start, it's situated next to the oldest structure, oldest historical building in Miami Beach. And one of the issues that we're going to have to contend with on that project is who gets to own history. You know, are we going to battle against people saying that you shouldn't put a skate plaza next to the oldest building in Miami Beach? Because, you know, there's a certain attitude about skateboarders. And my position is, you know, well, who gets to own history? Isn't it the most appropriate place for a generation who's emerging to learn about our cultural resources? And in fact, something like skateboarding, if you do it right and you learn that it's actually a family-oriented sport and those kids are actually given the right set of conditions and the right material and the right design, you get to nurture the right approach to respecting your environment and doing it the right way. You know, you're generating the right sort of attitude. I think these are things that you can nurture in the right way. I think we get better cities out of it all. So I believe you need to engender a creative expression through creative environments rather than the other way around. I think that it's not about so much the amenity. I think it's about leveraging every amenity with design. You see, for me, you could give me something very insignificant and I would try to make something out of it. I believe that we all need to take a little bit more time to design. So I'm okay with not having a complex amenity. It's just that I think we need to take a little bit more time to make more out of our amenities.
Margie Nothard is president of Glavovic Studio and designer of Arts Park in Hollywood, Florida. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. CityView's commentator Walker Smith will worry about aging and retirement later. Right now, he's too busy enjoying his midlife crisis.
All of my friends are having a midlife crisis. Me too. We've made it to that age, and we're responding on cue. We can't seem to keep from turning into caricatures of ourselves. My lawyer friends have all renounced the bar for new professions. My doctor friends have all cut back on their schedules. My CEO friends are all counting the days to early retirement. Several sports cars and second marriages have sprung up, and just about all of us are trying to make more regular appearances at church. My friends and I are part of the generation that grew up laughing at the overwrought angst of the characters in Woody Allen's many films. Of course, now that that angst is real, not imagined, it doesn't seem quite so funny anymore. The evidence of a generation in denial is all around us. The booming interest in nostalgia reflects an intense yearning to bask in the remembered glow of a youthful energy and vitality. Reunion tours for hit bands of the 60s and 70s are the biggest grossing musical shows of the past several years. 40 and 50-year-olds are behind the recent growth in things like adventure travel, motorcycles, and skydiving. Cosmetic surgery from LASIK to liposuction is booming among older people. Marketers use youthful imagery to sell Cadillacs and insure to older consumers. Youth culture is no longer the exclusive preserve of young people. More and more, it is literally something that helps preserve the youthful pretensions of 40 and 50-year-olds like me and my friends. But I think we need a different attitude about being 40 or 50-something. Now that I've reached middle age, I see that having a midlife crisis is a good thing, something to be welcomed and embraced. It's exactly the right thing for us to wrestle with at this point in our lives. After all, we've put in a lot of effort to get here. Because of that, we finally have the wisdom, the resources, and the stability it takes to think beyond ourselves. It's hard to be anything but selfish when we're young. When we're getting started, we have to stay focused on ourselves. Otherwise, we'll never get to a point where we can focus on things beyond ourselves. When we do get to this point, as my friends and I are today, it's good that we should begin to feel restless and uncertain. Angst is the prod we need to focus on something more. We've spent 20 or 30 self-absorbed years consumed by material obsessions. Now we have the ability to look beyond ourselves. And in today's world, what could be more important than this? At the same time, though, we can't approach our 40s and 50s, or our 60s and 70s, the same way in which we approached our 20s and 30s. We have to start to give back, not continue to take more. There is great potential left in the baby boom generation. We have decades to go in which we can still make a difference that counts. We are not over the hill. We are standing atop a great bluff, able now to see the broader view around us, not just the next foothold on the path to the top. If it takes a midlife crisis to make us see that we are not finished, that we have only just begun, that we can have more impact now than we had in our youth, then a midlife crisis is a wonderful thing. I wish you one, too. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.